Hello, and welcome to the Time Wars Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast.
My name is John Mayo.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about one of the Time Wars novels by Simon Hawke.
Alright, this is started. We're on D. I'm going to start both these. There we go. Now both are started. They're synced up. I'm going to put your phone about there in between us, because I'm going to reference mine for other stuff. That work?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In this episode, I am joined by my sister Kay, and we're going to be doing something a bit different this time around. We are going to be doing a series of episodes, 12, possibly more, on the Time Wars series. Now, this is a series of novels that I encountered in high school from a friend of mine. Loved them, reread them in college. The first one, which is what we're going to be talking about here, is The Ivanhoe Gambit by Simon Hawke. All the books are by Simon Hawke. But that's the first book in the Time Wars series. It was originally published in 1984 by Ace, I think it was. He's since gotten the rights back. It's now, of course, 30 years later. A little over. We're recording this in October 2017, and I'll be honest, I may sit on this recording for a bit as we do some of the others just so they can come out on a timely basis. But he did three books in 1984, another two in 85, then one in 86, 87, 88, 89, two in 90, finishing up the 12-issue series in 1991. In 2013, he's gotten the rights back and it put them up as ebooks under his own kind of banner or control, I guess would be the way to say. And under Goodreads, he's got a blog or the ability to post stuff there. It's indicative that he thinks there's more material to mine in this area, and he may do some more writing.
Nice.
It was interesting because I had loved his stuff back in the day, and it just, he stopped writing. Well, it turns out, based on what I've read from this stuff on Goodreads, that, you know, the glamorous life of a writer, for some is really glamorous, for others it's you're making ends meet, but you also don't get benefits and stuff like that. So he had some other jobs, he was teaching on the side, that sort of a thing. So he'd have the benefits, have more stability for his family and stuff, a perfectly reasonable thing to do. But then one of his students, I guess, said, you know, you could have a little bit easier time if you just work where I'm at. Which apparently was like a Home Depot or something. And he switched over to that, been there at the time of the writing of that article or whatever, 17 years or something.
Mm-hmm. And happens to a lot of people.
If it's a good company to work for and you're happy with it and doing it, oh, more power to you. A little upset myself because we haven't got more books, but this was a series that it's like, okay, I'll get the reissued paperback and then it's a matchbook on Amazon. So for another 99 cents, I get the Kindle version, which I was able to share with you, my sister.
Mm-hmm.
And we are on a trip right now. We're actually in Rapid City, South Dakota. We each read it on our Kindle so far on the trip, and we're sitting in a hotel room recording this. So again, when this goes up, it may be literally a year from now. I don't know. It depends when we get some of the others and stuff. This was a series I really enjoyed. And having read it not only originally back 30 years ago, but I love the series enough that around the time the final book was coming out, I reread the novels back up to that. So mm-hmm. I've read them twice, but that was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So I've had plenty of time to forget it. So there were parts of it when I was reading this, it's like, I know one or two of these characters is continuing, a few others, wait, what happened to them again?
Well, but just slow down to, I mean, reading it the first time, which was my experience, mm-hmm. the title.
Okay, The Ivanhoe Gambit. Let's give a little of the premise of the stuff. This is the Time Wars series, and the author's premise is in the future, 2163, I think is what it is.
2613.
2613. Okay, I was close. I had the right numbers, wrong order. Anyways, the way they fight wars is in the past. Two people or two nations have a dispute. They send, it's like, okay, we're going to put 10 people on this side. You're going to put 10 people on this side of this ancient battle of the Roman legion fighting somebody, or Custer's Last Stand, or the Civil War, or wherever. Whoever has the most survivors mm-hmm. wins.
Well, and they have a point system.
And they never, at least in this book, don't go into the point system, but it's you know, dead, wounded, whatever, apparently counts differently or what have you.
They have referees who judge the point spread.
There's an aspect of baseball's sabermetrics kind of thrown in with that, conceptually. And the basic idea is in the prologue and again in the epilogue, it goes through, here's what a recruiting drive is. You work at a company, the Army comes in and says, hey, this is a wonderful, great, exciting career. Look at the majestic aspect of history, how quaint and wonderful it was back then.
Go to a simpler time.
Go to a simpler time. Have an adventure, as if it's a vacation.
Yeah.
And it's a one-week sign-up. Well, how bad could a week be? That's a week current time. That week, you get sent back, say, at 9 a.m. for a six-month stint. You come back at 9:05.
Yeah.
It's a long week.
Well, and they did one really nice bit with that, where he was having drinks with someone.
Yeah, in the prologue, Lucas Priest, the main character we're initially introduced to, having drinks with another Army person he's just met, and they get shipped out to two different things. And when he comes back from his deployment, which we're kind of intercutting back and forth in the prologue between that, the recruitment thing, and the drinks at the temporal disportionment unit, whatever they call the place. When he comes back, the ice hasn't even melted from the drinks he'd been having with Jesse or whatever. And it's just kind of one of those, nothing's changed in the present, but you've aged 6 months. You've gone through this war. The other aspect that the author chose to do, which I thought was fascinating, things that we would consider literary figures or historical figures, and some historical figures may turn out to be literary figures.
Yeah.
But it kind of goes hand in hand with the fact that most Americans, I think, don't really know history.
Yeah.
They know the media version of history. They know the stories. They know Robin Hood. They don't know what was really happening at the time in England there.
Yeah.
So Robin Hood's a real person, not just a character or whatever. And in this mission, after the prologue, Lucas Priest is checking in on his Army buddies. And granted, he's been in the Army 3-4 days at this point, what they call plus time, present day minus time is in the past. And one of them is just getting back from a mission, so he says, hey, you know, I'll go see how he's doing. And since Lucas had been wounded in one of his things, one of his bonuses as part of that was either a furlough, a little extra time in the present, or pick your next assignment. So he chose to pick his next assignment and hang out with one of his surviving buddies, because he's going through a list of like 4 or 5 other people killed in action, missing in action, and the one he just had drinks with never made it in the deployment. They got lost in time or whatever. And some of this is just kind of things that the author is just sprinkling in throughout versus, you know, focusing on, which I thought was cool. But the mission comes down to that Bobby was assigned, Robert Johnson was assigned to, and Lucas kind of tags on, was one of their referees, the ones who are administrating these time wars and doing the point scores, has gone rogue and decided he's going to become Richard the Lionheart. He's going to become King of England. And of course, that'll mess up time pretty badly. So they've got to send a team to go do an adjustment and go fix that.
Well, he knows where Richard the Lionheart dies. And his theory is, if I never go there, I never die. I can do whatever I want.
Yes. And therefore, change the future, get rid of the people who are going to come chase me and fix it, because they wouldn't exist.
Yeah. Well, and at one point, the referee who's hunting him, he refers to it all as a game of roulette. And he says, all it takes is for that one possibility to arise in which I'm not sent another team.
Because what's happened is this is the third team that, quote-unquote, the good guys have sent back to go fix this. The other two have failed. Because once you're found out, the game changes. This one team is playing with a handicap of trying to maintain history. This rogue referee, Irving...
Goldblum.
Goldblum. His goal is essentially to change history. So if he goes a little rogue and changes stuff, that's actually in his favor. Because all he's got to do is not lose long enough for time to have changed to where they can't send people, or the people they send are from his future. And therefore, effectively on his side, trying to keep their own past intact.
Yeah.
So we get a little bit of... So we've got Lucas that we meet at the beginning of the prologue. We get introduced to Robert Johnson shortly thereafter. And then the other two members of the team, Finn Delaney, who's career military been busted up and down the ranks repeatedly.
Yes.
And apparently he's a lot smarter than we're initially led to believe.
Yeah.
Because there's the run-of-the-mill infantry type. Then there's the people who do the adjustments or whatnot. Then there are the observers, the referees, and kind of the overseers. And
the retrieval guys.
There's the retrieval guys, but also the cartographers.
Yes.
You don't want to materialize in the past in the middle of something, so they have people kind of almost like paratroopers go in with floater units so they can hover, mapping out the terrain.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a better chance of surviving when you get deployed.
Yeah.
But then the search and retrieval, if you get stuck in the past or once your mission is over and some team has won, they pull you back to the present.
Well, and they have rules of engagement.
Yes.
So when you're sent back into a war, you're given a list of, doesn't matter how much Scipio pisses you off, Scipio must survive the battle.
Yeah, you don't kill the historical figures. And you're fighting a war within a war. It doesn't really matter if the overall army or unit you're deployed into wins or not. Your goal is mainly to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And if it works in conjunction with their plan, great. If not, well, you want to survive.
Well, and they do a lot of cosmetic surgery.
That was one of the things I was wondering if you'd picked up on. Not the cosmetic surgery. Can you describe what any of the characters look like?
No, because they look like who they need to look like in the moment.
They look like who they need to look like in the moment, but there was only one or two references. Lucas had blonde hair,
yeah,
and stuff like that. When you get deployed into, you know, the Indian army to go fight Custer, you've got to look like an Indian.
Yeah.
You know, you go into the Roman Legion, you got to look Roman. You know, you go and you're effectively, not effectively, you are replacing Robin Hood or Sir Ivan Ho. You need to look like those guys. Specifically those guys, not just of the time.
Well, and they interrogated those guys for the memories and then used the learning implants.
Yeah.
That usually helped with language to fill in memories.
So they've got enough things for how people can learn the languages, the customs, and those sorts of things, and be given mission parameters without even necessarily realizing they've been given mission parameters. And it also gives the armies that they're dealing with the ability to, okay, you went and you messed up, you showed some technology to somebody who shouldn't, we're going to go wipe their memory and go fix that to smooth over the timeline.
Well, and at least in this time period, it was, well, okay, if you use something you shouldn't, they'll probably believe it's sorcery.
Yeah.
Witchcraft. Don't worry, you might get burned at the stake, but
exactly.
Other than that, it's okay.
If they believe it's witchcraft, that's not necessarily a good or a bad thing. I liked how later in the book, one character is telling another, where you're going, this is the situation, I know you want to fight this guy and kill him for revenge. I get it, I'm okay with that. The armor you've got will give you an advantage, but you're going into a place that is already accusing somebody of witchcraft and they're ready to burn her at the stake.
Mm-hmm.
You're going in as that person's champion. So they're willing to believe a sorcerer could have called another sorcerer. So when that armor doesn't get damaged, you could get burned at the stake.
Yeah.
You know, kind of those aspects of it. It was a fun read. I felt it was a good page turner. The author never gets bogged down in so-and-so was a 6'2", yada yada, wearing this, you know, descriptive flowery prose. Yet you get to feel like you know these characters pretty well. You get a sense of them.
Mm-hmm.
Even if all you get is Finn Delaney's built like a gorilla. Okay, he's a big guy.
Well, what you get bogged down in is, I want to say, the philosophy. The debates.
The quandary.
Yes.
Because there are times of one of the people in the past, Andre Delacroix, is been recruited by this rogue referee, who she thinks, or he thinks. That's the thing. It turns out Andre is a she, posing as a he, because it's medieval times.
Mm-hmm.
But she's trying to figure out, do I kill him or not? Can I kill him or not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, one, is she able to actually kill him? And two, what are the ramifications of this? And just the do I or don't I things.
Well, she's realized the person she thought was Richard the Lionheart. And when she was recruited, it was, well, of course, you know, Richard the Lionheart calls you. Of course you answer. But now she's realized, wait a sec. I think this is an imposter, but I'm committed because he knows my secret.
Yes, he could reveal her as her and put her in grave danger.
Yeah.
Another time, Lucas is debating, you know, does this referee know what I know? Do I do this? Do I not? And kind of the almost talking yourself in and out of action based on what you think the other person does or doesn't know.
Well, I think Hooker, the fourth member of the adjustment team, probably had the best situation in terms of he is given pretty solid evidence he's going to die on the mission.
I would say when he discovers his body beheaded, he definitely has solid evidence. And yes, this is a spoiler-filled episode, by the way. And it really spoiled things for Hooker, because he's like, I don't like this.
Well, Finn did some good double talk.
Well, because, yeah, at this point, Hooker's kind of freaking out, as anyone would be, of
that's
the
me.
Other guy materialized, dropped my dead body here, and says, hey, you know, I know who you are, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But Finn, who, again, career military, at this point, seems pretty much just like a grunt, is basically telling Hooker, hey, you know, there had to be a timeline in which you didn't die, so if you can keep that timeline going, you're all right, you know.
Yeah.
And convinces Hooker, you know, just
keep your
paranoid.
Eyes open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Be prepared. You've got a warning you didn't have before. That's to your advantage.
But then later, Hooker realizes he is in the same place as the armor that has the...
He's in a situation where he can control his own demise.
Yes.
He's been captured at this point a few chapters later by the rogue referee.
And he's being interrogated ruthlessly.
And he's already been identified as Ivanhoe's second. He's his assistant or, you know, whatever the term would be, squire or whatever. But he hasn't revealed Bobby and Finn mm-hmm. as Robin Hood and Little John.
Well, the one piece of information he gives up is Lucas's name, because Irving referred to Lucas by name when he dropped the body.
Mm, right.
So it's, okay, I know what information he had at the time, so I know what it's safe to say without betraying anything, without revealing anything else, but I can guarantee I don't give more.
Yeah. What I found interesting with that point is, prior to this, people have been dropped in the past, and time is flowing forward. This is the first time we get another jump into the past and the timeline sort of potentially changing or not question.
They did a lot of conversation about...
time splits.
Yeah, I was going to say that is it a pebble, is it a rock, is it a boulder in the stream of time? And time is determined to come back together.
Well, there's a temporal inertia, essentially. Time has happened. If you change it, it's going to try to go back on the path of least resistance, which should be to the path it was on originally.
Time is determined to flow the way it was going to flow. It's not planning to be like the missing river up in Canada, where its path got changed so utterly it now goes down the other side of the mountain.
But the supposition in this world is the grandfather paradox. He's not resolved by you try to go shoot your grandfather and your gun jams, you just can't do it, none of that stuff. You could, but there's going to be ramifications. And it comes down to, are you or your grandfather really that important?
Yeah.
You know, could somebody else have done what you needed to do? Or, now, there's the literal grandfather paradox portion of it, of you couldn't exist and then not exist sort of a thing. But that's one of those where, in most of those cases, once they properly introduce the quandary or the paradox, and discuss it for a bit that you can really understand it, they usually go on the, nobody's been stupid enough to try this yet that we know of, and or, my God, it's giving me a headache, can we talk about something else?
Yeah.
In other words, the characters are going through the same mental anguish you are as you're
reading. Yeah.
And not mental anguish as you're reading it, but you know what I mean? It's like, yeah.
Struggle.
Yeah. This is not straightforward. You've got to experiment on this, and that could be horrifically bad for all of stuff.
Well, and all the characters have that implant, which, among other things, allows the tracking. And Lucas gets clobbered in the head pretty bad at a point when, because he's wearing a hood and stuff, Delacroix doesn't realize it's Ivanhoe.
Yeah.
And among other things, his implant gets knocked out, or at least broken,
damaged. It gets
damaged.
Whether it gets taken out or not by Reese Hunter, who they meet at that point, I don't recall. But it's one of those things that... What this adjustment team hadn't realized or been told conveniently by the referee who sent them was, yeah, the other guy can track you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of those, it's like you can track in this crowd somebody has a cell phone or something. You couldn't necessarily narrow it down to the person without the right equipment,
yeah,
a little bit of time. And, you know, this point in the medieval England, you'd be, you know, a sorcerer at that point.
I was going to say, you know, you need something the size of a briefcase or larger that's full of magic that nobody's going to simply glance by and say, oh yeah, that's a laptop, no big deal.
Even if it was as small as a Star Trek tricorder, people would be, what the hell is that?
Yeah, exactly.
I do think Reese gave a good explanation later at one point to that sort of, what is it, how to explain to somebody from that period?
Mm. Yes, the music.
The music, the technology and stuff, by putting them of, okay, a caveman to you. You're in armor, they'd be like, what is that? So the author, Simon Hawke, I think does a really good job explaining that kind of thing and giving the context.
I wasn't sure, I mean, Hunter seems to blow it off as I'm lonely. I wasn't really sure why Hunter decided to both rescue and keep hold of De La Croix.
I took it as he's just not a bloodthirsty type. De La Croix got into a situation beyond her control. He's not so callous as to just kill indiscriminately.
But he got her out of there and could have left her to her own devices and didn't.
Yes, agreed. I am expecting more of that in future books. In other words, I don't think this will be the last time we see those characters.
Yeah, that's the impression I got.
And I don't know, well, given that the first book, as I got it, was book one of the Time Wars series. Simon Hawke, I think, set out with, I'm telling more than one book. And the first three came out in 84, so he probably already had plans for the next two or three.
Well, we started with Lucas, Bobby, Finn, Hooker.
Let's stop for just a second there. Every character has a rank, a name, often a nickname. The name has a first and a last name, and then they're posing as somebody.
Yeah.
So we have Sergeant Major Lucas Priest, who becomes Ivanhoe.
Yes.
We have Robert Benjamin Johnson, who becomes Robin Hood.
Yes, and that was Bobby.
That was Bobby.
Yes.
Finn Delaney, who's been knocked down a couple of ranks, and he is Little John.
Yes.
Corporal, I forget Hooker's first name.
So do I.
He, and I can't pronounce the character he becomes.
Poignard or something?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Who's like the
squire.
Squire for Ivanhoe.
Yeah. Well, and that actually takes me back to one of my comments with the title. I knew Ivanhoe is a Robin Hood book, but I've never read it.
It's actually by Walter Scott. So when the referee is saying, okay, guys, you're about to go on your mission, he leaves off with the phrase Walter Scott, which triggers the implants, and suddenly they get this flood of all these memories.
See, I was thinking it was one of the Howard Pyle ones.
I don't know.
Okay. No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
What I enjoy about these books is you don't have to be a historian to really understand them. And he gives you enough of this is why they're doing this sort of a thing. I mean, to me, a good sci-fi writer is explaining kind of what's going on.
Well, the sheriff and Maid Marian was hilarious.
Yes, the backstory there of he had married her of sorts.
Yes.
He was. There was a bit of a taming of the shrew there going on, too.
Yes, yes.
But that was one of the things that hadn't gotten into, through the interrogation, into the memory implants. So when Bobby is Robin Hood saying, yeah, we encountered the sheriff, and she's like, so you dealt with my husband? And he's like, huh?
Yeah.
Because he didn't realize at that point. I mean, they give enough of the backstory and stuff of these merry men and what's going on to piece everything together. It was a very accessible story in that respect, both in terms of the rules of time travel, the rules of this era of society, and just how everybody's motivation was kind of going along.
Mm-hmm.
There was, aside from Reese, that was, okay, he's a deserter, he's on his own. Again, why does he befriend De La Croix? Most of the motivation for the characters I thought was well explained and just made sense.
Yeah.
And there's a good solid flow to the book.
Well, and Hunter's motivation for helping Lucas revealed itself. It took a while.
Well, and there's a certain amount of these deserters, while they're doing it under their own rules and inertia, are still working for the Time Corps in a very real sense.
I thought that was poetic and funny.
Yeah, because when the Observer reveals himself, and he's been in the story the whole time, most of the time, and is basically saying, yeah, it's too bad we couldn't get Reese with us. There was a, because we've got to punish him, but he's working for us, so I'm not going to punish him too hard, but don't desert, because that's bad. And kind of trying to toe the...
But they're the ones who are preserving history during the peaceful times.
Yeah.
Whereas we are the ones fighting the time wars and preserving history during war times.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting balance.
Yeah, and because you're not going to send armored troops or whatever into, you know, peaceful London or
mm-hmm.
middle of nowhere America or Asia or wherever, because there's no war to fight.
Yeah.
It begs the question of how much of that has been well mapped out by the cartography sort of units and stuff like that. It was one where I thought the author did a good job of explaining enough of how the army and the time wars worked
mm-hmm.
and clearly seems to have thought out other aspects, but it's one novel. He's not giving everything all at once.
Well, and the epilogue was kind of humorous.
We've been reading this on the Kindle, and at one night we'd stopped. It's a prologue, 15 chapters, and an epilogue. And we'd stopped after 13.
Yes.
And by this point, Finn and Lucas are pretty much done with their story. And I'm like,
yeah.
I don't remember what happens for the next two chapters. This is where we get Reese and De La Croix's kind of follow-on.
Yeah.
And then in the epilogue, it very much mirrors the prologue of here's a recruitment drive. But this time, instead of Lucas saying, yeah, I bet none of these people have gone to war or whatever, they seem too pretty, too soft. He's actually telling somebody, these guys haven't gone to war. They're too pretty, too soft.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid, Rick or whatever, is like, ah, well, it's an adventure. I'm going to go sign up. It sounds like fun. You survived. I'll survive, kind of.
Yeah.
And it's unclear, because at the end of the mission that they successfully complete, the two other units had not. Finn and Lucas are basically given a promotion, a 6-month vacation wherever they want it, and if they want out, they're out.
But if they re-up, they're
time commandos.
Yeah, for adjustments only.
Yeah.
Which I thought was an interesting promotion.
If you've got a team that are individuals that have survived this sort of a mission.
Yeah.
And you've sent others and they haven't. But it begs the question as to how big the time commandos are.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had proven they could think on their feet.
Yes.
In a whole different way than people just fighting in the Time Wars do.
Well, because they were outclassed. They were going up against a referee that had more knowledge of the time stream and time manipulation, had a chronoplate to actually do time travel. They didn't have that. He could track them to some degree.
Yeah.
And
he certainly had, I mean, encyclopedia worth of information they didn't have.
Yeah. And in theory, they were trying to not change the timeline.
Yeah.
That kind of goes out the window when Reese comes into the picture and starts handing out submachine guns.
Well, there is that.
Because at one point they're like, well, we know he's in this castle. Let's just take out Richard the Lionhearted. We'll smooth over killing the king later. But then he points out, you don't know which guy is him. Now, one of them's going to be in really good armor. Take a machine gun, mow the rest down. Whoever gets back up, that's your guy.
They did have the interesting quandary, though, of where is the real Richard the Lionheart?
Is he alive? Is he not? Can he be put back? The referee who's on the good side would have to get the cosmetic surgery to look like him, live his life according to historical doctrine, and die when he dies. It's a death sentence for him. The guy sending him out says, you may not survive this, but if you do, I won't.
Yeah.
But that's the job. And I liked how there were the philosophical quandaries on that.
Yeah.
The are we doing the right thing? Are we not? When can we play a little fast and loose with the timeline? When should we not? There's the implication that there's an almost another story that happens after this of the cleanup crew,
mm-hmm.
who's kind of gotta reset the not the timeline, but smooth things over.
Yeah.
You know, people who are retired to there to live out in place of the people who got killed or whatever. It was a fun novel. And most of it is around those handful of characters we talked about. Reese Hunter, the deserter. Obviously the evil ref. The one at the beginning's not really dealt with much later.
Well, the one interesting thing he took the time to explore in subplots was Prince John was able to rise to power because King Richard went to the Holy Land for the Crusades.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the moment when Ivanhoe has just won all of these jousting competitions, and it's, you know, you have to name the queen of the festival or whatever, and he's exhausted, and it's just, I'm gonna give it to some Norman. I'm done with this.
I don't want to cause any problems. Let's not give it to a Saxon.
Yeah.
And he gives it to a Jew.
Yeah.
He's like, I picked a Jewish girl. They're not gonna like that, are they? And he can't, he realizes it right after he does it. He can't undo that.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because at that tournament, Bobby has made his entrance as Robin Hood, doing mm-hmm. the split the arrow of the other guy using high-tech stuff. Lucas is not wanting to reveal himself as Ivanhoe because Ivanhoe's essentially girlfriend and father are there, and he doesn't want to get into that if he can avoid that.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things, you've got this jousting tournament, and and I like, again, how the author explains. If you take the handle in and kind of knock it against the shield, it's a friendly joust. If you take the spear in and do it, it's a not so friendly joust.
Mm-hmm.
And that when Lucas is on his horse making his entrance, he charges down, spears, and knocks all the shields off, saying, I'll take them all on, damn it.
Yeah. And then his high-tech lance breaks in the first joust.
He's got one or two advantages, the magnifying zoom on the helmet, the high-tech joust with the sonic blast. And of course, it's army issue, so it works a time or two.
Yeah.
And I like how they have the high-tech toys, but it's not, oh, it'll get us out of everything.
I liked who they had loan him lances to be able to continue competing. I thought they did some nice stuff there, and playing on the he's a poor knight and doing it well.
In explaining that when a knight loses, his armor and horse are essentially given to the winner to ransom back.
Yeah.
If he's willing to.
Yes.
And how when it was Delacroix's turn to get mm-hmm. the stuff back or whatever,
mm-hmm.
he's like, hey, I learned some... You know, he was basically given a nice out of this, a sign of respect.
Yeah.
And I thought the way Hunter, or not Hunter, Hooker, gave the explanation of, and keep a little for yourself, is, you know...
Yes, to the brother.
To the brother of Delacroix.
Yeah.
And I thought the brother and Delacroix were set up well.
Yeah.
I mean, they were not characters that were just... Not main characters that were just placeholders.
Yeah.
A couple of the other knights were not heavily dived. We didn't get their background, their childhood, but it's not their story.
Most of the Norman knights were just bad.
Bad, callous, and by today's standards, you know, not so good people.
Yeah.
But also playing on the difference of standards. That yes. These knights, these time agents come from a more civilized time. You know, women are treated better, the whole race relationship is just not as, mm-hmm. as crazy as it was back then.
Well, and the whole, come on, you're doing the tournament so that they'll be happy before they pay the taxes.
Yes. I was a little surprised we didn't get a little bit more rob from the rich, give to the poor, sort of, in the Robin Hood side. But that was more the subplot
yeah.
than the main plot.
Mm-hmm.
It was very much Lucas's story, and Bobby was... I don't say relegated to sidekick status, but supporting.
Yeah, he was. And I was sorry to see him not make it out.
But the fact that half the team dies on the mission shows that there are definite risks and consequences for this.
Yeah, very true.
If we'd gone through and all four guys made it out, it's like, yeah, it wasn't so bad.
Yeah. Well, I'll be honest. Because I was worried about how was the evil ref going to die. I mean, they'd talked about... If we kill him in front of witnesses, we have a problem mm-hmm. because they think he's Richard the Lionheart, or they might.
Yeah.
If they see him. I liked how he died. His technology took him out.
Well, at this point in the story, we've gotten to where it looks like, from the onlooker's point of view, Ivanhoe is going after Richard the Lionheart. They're swinging their swords or whatever.
Was he Richard the Lionheart at that point, or the Black Knight?
Oh, maybe he was the Black Knight and the Green Knight. Both were... In different colored armor. You're right. You're right. My bad.
I think he was the Green Knight at that point.
I thought Lucas was. I forget. This is the problem with me reading a novel. I have a hard time keeping an entire comic book of 20 pages in my head, much less a full-on novel. At any point, Lucas and the evil referee are fighting in whatever color armor, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the referee is willing to cheat. He's got a chronoplate. He uses his retrieval thing, bounce back to the plate, reset, go back, be behind Lucas. Lucas quickly realizes what's going on. The thing is, at this point, Lucas has Reese, who has a chronoplate. So Reese pulls him back, resets, puts him out there.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got, what happens is it would be like they multiply out as they're almost fighting in reverse to a degree over a few second thing, and then it collapses down. What happens is Lucas is kind of left on the field by himself, and he's wondering, what happened? Well, what happened, and this is, I thought, very clever, is the evil ref, Irving, has realized, I'm getting tired. This guy's doing all right. He's got good armor, too. I can't take him alone. I've got this other knight under my control. Let's bring Delacroix in. The two of us can do it. Well, the problem is Delacroix is about to go kill the person who killed her brother.
Mm.
She's mid-swing as the ref calls her in and continues her swing.
Yeah, because she doesn't know the ref can even do that.
Yeah, and she's like, what just happened?
Yeah.
And, of course, the timing on that is Hunter had sent Finn to go get the chrono plate. Right after that happened, Finn barges in the door and knocks her down, puts explosives on the plate.
Yeah.
There are a few things like that where the timing is a little convenient, whatever.
Yeah, but beautiful.
But beautiful, dramatic, it plays well as a story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Simon Hawke did a good job of playing fair throughout this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking when I read it way back, I still think today, it would make for a fun series of either movies or a TV series. Because I think there's a lot of good action, adventure sort of things to have. I mean, you've got Robin Hood, you've got the swashbuckling kind of, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Action hero or whatnot. There's the sword fighting, the jousting.
Yeah.
You've got the time travel. I'm not saying it would be a cheap show to go do.
No.
But if you could get the right actors and the right sensibility, I think it could be a lot of fun.
I agree.
So I enjoyed this quite a bit. This was your first read of it. Anything mm-hmm. else kind of jump out at you as good, bad, and different?
I got confused by how few days he had been in the service. So I actually had to bookmark those.
There was one place he mentioned he'd been in 4 days and Bobby had been in 3.
Yeah, that I had to actually look at. One of the descriptions I liked, because like you were saying, he does just some great descriptions and explanations for like explaining modern recordings of music to the woman from the past.
He does good explanations. He's terse on the descriptions.
Yeah, well, but the one I liked was when he was saying you might think that a man from the Middle Ages, since even the smallest modern man would be on par at least with the largest knight. But then he says, however, that did not take into account the fact that these were men who were accustomed to a harsher way of life, mm-hmm. to more primitive conditions, and needless to say, to moving about in heavy suits of armor. These men were far from being weaklings. I liked how he described things like that.
Yeah, because it's that perspective of, well, we're the smarter, more civilized, more intelligent.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we're not used to fighting on horseback. We're not used to the tactics of that or you know, how to best use an archery team or whatever.
Well, and just talking about the physical weight of that armor. You know, at one point, Lucas says that he tried to kind of collapse his body as dead weight when people were lifting him and his armor up onto a horse so they wouldn't realize how much lighter his armor was.
Yes. He had a nigh steel armor or whatever and shield. And I liked how the shield got used later by the bad guy, one of the bad knights. But they had some technological advantages, but it was also, let's be careful that it doesn't give us away as evil sorcerers or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I liked that explanation. I also liked the explanation about how the music stuff worked.
Mm-hmm.
And Reese explaining it as kind of, it's like writing, but not quite. Just mm-hmm. kind of go with me on this, understand the concept. And, you know, I thought that was good. I'm trying to think if there were any parts of the explanation where... Yeah, it's funny because there are some authors, Asimov is one of them, that'll go into, well, we've got a ray gun. How does the ray gun work? What's the history of this? It's about a 3-page digression onto that.
Yeah.
And it's dense. It's good, but it's not easy reading.
Yeah.
Whereas here, the stuff flowed through. It was a good casual explanation, conversational explanation.
Mm-hmm.
And not one that I thought bogged down the story. Now, there were a few places where, again, here's how they recruit, here's how they do this. But it was interesting, it was fun, it was enjoyable.
Yeah. Well, and the quandaries got intense.
Yeah. Do I do this? Do I not? Did I do this because he did that? You know, how do you play the player kind of psychology stuff?
Well, when Delaney was telling Hooker, there's only one way we're going to make it through this thing, and that's to act as though nothing is real as far as the future is concerned.
Yeah. Well, and that was one of those points where Finn Delaney's backstory started to reveal itself, as he had been tested well enough to be in the referee or observer corps or whatever, but it just, he wasn't of that mindset.
Yeah.
But he's got more knowledge about the temporal physics and such.
Yeah.
And then you've got somebody like Lucas, who's just pretty quick on the uptake. And the fact that, you know, Hooker and Bobby kind of, let's go walk it off, Hooker. And that gives Lucas and Finn a chance to, that's not true, is it? And Finn Delaney explaining, I kind of sold him this. It's not true, but it's what he needed to hear.
And what he wanted to believe.
What he wanted to believe.
Yeah.
Because you've got Hooker, who's just a raw recruit. You've got Finn Delaney, who's got who knows how much experience in the Corps.
Yeah.
As one of these fighters.
Well, and the quote from Finn Delaney, I had it up a second ago. You've got a choice to make right now, son. You can either resign yourself to this fate, he pointed at the nearly severed head of the corpse, or you can determine that you're going to do everything in your power to prevent this from happening, from ever happening.
Yeah.
And it was that resign yourself to this fate. I think they were all afraid that Hooker was about to give up in a very real sense.
Or become useless to them.
Yes.
And just break.
Yeah.
It definitely goes towards, again, Finn's experience of how to handle people.
Well, it was an interesting difference between, it's one thing to know the future. It's a whole different thing to know your future.
But that's one of the other things that was planted earlier in the book, is time travel has always been backwards for them. They go back to the past.
Yes.
Nobody's been brave enough to go to the future.
Yeah.
And there's kind of, it's not written yet, it's not safe, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
There are quite a few things that are just, again, sprinkled throughout in terms of you know, how does the then-present view everything from cigarettes and drugs on up and down. It's a fun read. I thought it was, again, I've read some books that are just unbelievable page-turners, and I get through them in no time at all. Once Upon a Time in the East was one of those, another time travel series, but much more of a Western feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where that series, you know how you've got the shootout at the, or the gunfight and the tumbleweed going through? The author really got that sense of time and space and
nice
and whatnot. But it was a little bit lighter fare. This has a little bit more meat to it. There are a couple of places that if you want to pause and really chew on the meat of the story, there's stuff to think about there, which I love. Yet it's not as dense as, say, an Asimov book, where it's almost a historical treaty on how they developed the laws of robotics or this ray gun or whatever, psychohistory or whatnot. Here we get what we need, and we get some exposition. But there is not a place where I felt, geez, they've paused the story, they're dumping exposition on me, I gotta take notes, what the hell, come on, move on. None of that.
Yeah.
It was what we needed, as we needed, and it flowed pretty well. So I thought this was, again, a fun read. I'm glad Simon Hawke has got the full rights, has released, I believe, all 12 back again on at least Amazon. I'm sure they're available elsewhere. Before they were the standard mass market paperbacks, now they're a little bit larger, clearly kind of a almost a home done print on demand sort of thing, but it allows him to keep complete control. I think at one point he tried doing ebooks and they were typos. He wasn't happy. So him doing it the way he wants to, well, it doesn't have quite the mass market polish the original series had. The first, at least, first six or seven have the original covers. But he decided to go very minimalist after that with just text. It was faster, cheaper, and just didn't, he didn't like the later covers, I think. Not saying he was overjoyed with the original ones either. But he's got them all out there. If you get them on Amazon, what I'm doing is, rather than paying like $9.99 or whatever for the Kindle book, I'm paying the $12.95 or whatever for the print book and the 99-cent matchbook to get the Kindle after that. One, so we can share, and two, to support the author.
Yeah.
I want him to feel this is worthwhile to do and hopefully do some more books. Because he's done this series of the Time Wars. He did the Wizard of Fourth Street series, the Reluctant Sorcerer series. He did a couple of books for Star Trek, Dungeons and Dragons, maybe even Battlestar Galactica, a few other one-off books. I like his writing.
Yeah.
It's a good style. It's fun. It's enjoyable. So you like this and you're willing to keep going on the books?
Yeah.
Anything else on this one? Are we good?
I think we're good.
Cool.
The show notes and form for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.